Well, brethren and sisters, you're going to get a minimum of me tonight. This is Brother Sperry Lecture, and this is Brother Brigham's talk. And I've been asked to talk on this subject of Brigham Young and education. Brother Sperry and I used to spend long hours talking about education in the church because we had offices side by side and because we agreed perfectly on all subjects relating thereto. But recently, and I have got a lot of montages together on Brigham Young and education and so forth in the past, but recently, talks by Brothers Packer and King and Rogers, recently Dilworth Young, Noel Reynolds, have brought to the fore new facets of the problem of education on which Brigham Young had a lot to say. So this is stuff we haven't had before. First, we'd start out, however, with some general principles that are very important in understanding Brigham Young's position here. The keynote of all his thinking and preaching is the wonder and glory of the gospel against the background of the lost and distracted world. Here was the race of mankind living lives of quiet desperation in a lone and dreary world, which they firmly believed would eventually pass away and leave not a rack behind. Into this world of frustrated, restless, unhappy creatures there came one who told them who they really were and bore ample credentials to the bona fides of the great revelations he brought them. The news was overpowering, almost too good to be true. From now on, everything was going to be different. Brigham Young couldn't keep from shouting hallelujah all the day long and invited everyone else to come and see. His whole concern, he says, is to learn all there is to know this marvelous message and then pass it on to everyone he possibly could. I have a million quotations from Brigham Young here. There's going to be just time for one or two on each topic, you see, but it's Brigham's idea. Rather than say quote, which is an ugly word, maybe I should raise my hand every time it's Brigham speaking here. He says, there was more or less of a gloom over my feelings from the earliest days of my childhood than I have any recollection until I heard the everlasting gospel declared by the servants of God. The secret feeling of my heart was that I would be willing to crawl around the earth on my hands and knees to see such a man as Peter, Jeremiah, Moses, or any other man like that. And when I saw Joseph Smith, he took heaven, figuratively speaking, and brought it down to earth, and he took earth and brought it up and opened up in plainness and simplicity the things of God. Under that preaching, the gloom vanished, and not since has troubled me for a moment. I gave away all that I had and started to preach the gospel. I was obliged to do it, for I felt as though my bones would consume within me if I did not. Consequently, I devoted my time to preaching. So there you have it. Outside of our religion, he says, the religion we have embraced, there is nothing but death, hell, and the grave. In one of his letters, he says, nothing like this has been seen on the earth for centuries. What an educational project lay before those who accepted this message. The gospel is knowledge, and its recipients had first to acquaint themselves with it as quickly and fully as possible, and then disseminate it with all possible skill and speed. Put forth your ability to learn as fast as you can. Gather all the strength of mind and principle of faith you possibly can, and then distribute your knowledge to the people. We are here to live, to spread intelligence and knowledge among the people. I am here to school my brethren, to teach my family the way of life. Remember the great principle, learn, 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 and so forth and so forth and so forth. The curriculum is, of course, unlimited. We should not only learn the principles of education known to mankind, we should reach out further than this, learning to live so that our minds will gather in information from the heavens and the earth until we can incorporate in our faith and understand all knowledge. This concept of education is implicit in Mormonism. Can't get away from it. Once we categorically assume a career of eternal progression, no other way lies open. For the course ahead absolutely requires sustained, progressive, ever-increasing mental power and exertion. To be alive is to be conscious. To be conscious is to think, and to think is to think about something. Illustration, the mind craves knowledge as the body craves food. The gospel not only requires such application of the mind, but facilitates and guarantees it. Brigham says there's no position a man can occupy in this world wherein he can learn so much of that which is truly valuable and worthy of acceptation as that of an elder in the Church of Jesus Christ in the active discharge of his calling. The present is the day of your opportunity to mold your character, strengthen your faith, develop your powers of mind and thought. For Brigham Young, knowledge is what Aristotle would call a good of first intent, of primary intent, a thing good and desirable in itself, needing no argument or excuse for its existence. Goods of secondary intent are good for something, are good for something else. A hammer, a watch, a pair of shoes, a ladder, a knife. Each is good because it helps us get something else that's good and we need, something we're after. But there are other goods whose value doesn't depend on anything else. It's intrinsic and immediate, and knowledge is one of them. Joseph Smith feasted on knowledge. He said it tasted good to him. Paradoxically, these things of primary intent are actually the most useful ones. In fact, they're the only useful ones in the long run. Brigham Young said again and again, we can get along without all the other stuff very well, and we've had to do it, and we're blessed because we had to do it. If it's necessary, you can do with only a crust of Johnny cake. That's enough. That's all you need, and a little buttermilk, he used to say. But the goods of primary intent, you can never do without them. Without them, life is not possible. We wither and die. They're incorporated in our very nature. Truth cleaves unto truth because it is truth, and it is to be adored because it is an attribute of God, for its excellence, for itself. Will education feed and clothe you, keep you warm on a cold day, or enable you to build a house? Not at all. Should we cry down education on this account? No. What is it for? Now, this is Brigham Young speaking. I'm not getting this from anybody around here, I assure you. The improvement of the mind. The improvement of the mind to instruct us in all the arts and sciences, in the history of the world, in the laws of nations, to enable us to understand the laws and principles of life, how to be useful while we live. Brigham, like Joseph Smith, often repeated the maxim, this is Mormonism embraces all truth that is revealed and is unrevealed, whether religious, political, scientific, or philosophical. We cannot cross the bounds of knowledge into new territory until we've traversed the expanse of ground that lies between us. The outmost limit, and Brigham Young says, we as a people have in the future to excel the nations of the earth in religion, science, and philosophy. But to surpass them, we first have to catch up with them. We should not only learn the principles of education known to mankind, that being the first step, but we should reach out further than this. Learn to live so our minds will gather in information from the heavens and the earth until we can incorporate in our faith and understanding all knowledge. It's the belief and doctrine of the Latter-day Saints. Learn everything the children of men know and be prepared for the most refined society on the face of the earth. These ideas have become commonplaces with us, but Brigham Young is known before all else as a hard, practical, common sense man. Practical, that was his genius. And this leads us to the common fallacy of classing one kind of activity as practical by nature and the other as impractical by nature. Brigham Young's been accused of inconsistency in insisting that knowledge should be sought for its own sake on one hand, but primarily for its practical application on the other. There's no contradiction, you see. He knows that the person who does not regard the most practical task primarily as a mental exercise is going to bungle it, is going to be a waster and a bungler, not going to do it properly. He says you will almost invariably find that people who are industrious in the common pursuits of life are industrious in improving their minds as far as they have opportunity. Intelligence is not a monopoly of a particular kind of work or a particular class or age or stage of advancement. A smart baby is far more edifying company than a stupid dean. I've spent many hours in the company of both. He says here, and while you delight in raising flowers and so forth, do not neglect to learn how to take care of the cream, how to make of it good wholesome butter, and of the milk, good healthy nutritious cheese. Neither forget your sewing, spinning, weaving. I would not have you neglect to learn music. I would encourage them to read history and the scriptures, to take up a newspaper, geography, other publications, make themselves acquainted with the manners and customs of distant kingdoms and nations, with their laws, religion, geographical location, on the face of the world, their climate, natural productions, the extent of their commerce, the nature of their political organizations, on and on. You see, in fine, let our boys and girls be thoroughly instructed in every useful branch of physical and mental education. Let this education begin early. Now, in a passage like that, try to separate the book learning from the other. It can't be done. For Brigham Young, it is all practical, and it is all a wonderful adventure of the mind. On Sunday, the 12th, he writes in his Brigham Young History, I addressed people from the stand. I observed that our business was with the things immediately before us and not with the glories of the eternal world. Or again, he says, the kingdom we are talking about, preaching about, and trying to build up is the kingdom of God on earth, not in the starry heavens. My mission to the people is to teach them with regard to their everyday lives. I presume there are many who have heard me say years and years ago that I cared very little about what will take place after the millennium. My desire to teach the people what they should do now and let the millennium take care of itself, to teach them to serve God and build up His kingdom, is my mission. Yet this is the same man who tells us, quote, instead of reflecting on and searching for the hidden things of greatest value to them, the Latter-day Saints rather wish to learn how to secure their way through the world as easily and comfortably as possible. The reflections of what they're here for, who produce them, where they're from, far too seldom enter their minds. Well, is there a contradiction here between the practical Brigham and the other, one who says, think only of heaven, the other says, never think of heaven? No, there's not contradiction here at all. For Brigham, what is practical is the task at hand, the thing that had to be done right now, whether it was praying, bathing, dancing, sleeping, or shoeing a horse. All were equally practical, including dancing, equally temporal and spiritual. He says there is no difference in spiritual and temporal labors. All are one, because each one at the proper time helps us on the way to our objective, and it's always the same single objective for all of them. There are no two categories of knowledge here at all. Brigham is teaching the saints How to climb Jacob's ladder. How to do it in a sensible, practical way, grasping firmly the next rung above and not grabbing wildly for something up near the top, and thus proceeding carefully and surely, step by step, line upon line, precept upon precept. This does not mean, as many suppose, that he's telling them to forget the ultimate goal, that they must never lose sight of, the spirit, the millennium, or the eternity, and come down to earth and devote themselves to the common sense bread-and-butter affairs of everyday life, the realities of life. No, that is an entirely different ladder. Brother Packer uses a very useful term here. Which ladder are you climbing? Both ladders, the bread-and-butter existence and the spirit, are climbed in the same way. But the ladders are worlds removed from each other. The rules of success are the same in business, the arts, science, crime, and the military. But ladders are not the same. There's a little difference there, but the same qualities of character necessary, persistence, dedication, etc., etc. This is the lesson we should study, says Brigham. No, never lose sight of the goal. The powers of our minds and bodies should be governed and controlled in a way that will secure to us an eternal increase, while the inhabitants of the earth are bestowing all their ability, both mental and physical, upon the perishable objects. Those who profess to be Latter-day Saints, who have the privilege of receiving and understanding the principles of the Holy Gospel, are in duty bound to study and find out and put in practice in their lives those principles that are calculated to endure, that will tend to a continual increase and this in this and in the world to come. There's an entirely different ballgame there, isn't it? And thus we teach the people how to live. This is our business. If you do not learn to live here, how can you live hereafter? It's the hereafter you have in mind in the whole time, you see. If you do not understand the things of this life, how can you understand the things that pertain to this life? I remember how disturbed my mother was. One occasion, a visit from general authority, we used to be visited them by them often in the mission field at our house. She announced at the dinner table that it was more important for a girl to learn how to make a pot of soup than to recite Shakespeare. As he saw it, there was a necessary conflict between the two. No girl could do both. But Brigham Young says this: make good houses, make good soup, learn how to build, become good mechanics and businessmen, that you may know how to build a house, a barn, a storehouse, how to make a farm, and how to raise stock and take care of it. On the other hand, in the same sentence, he says, the neighborhood or community that adorns its city, farms, gardens, and supremely loves and sets its affection on these things had better never had seen it or had anything like that to enjoy. Don't stop there. If that's your object, to make the soup, then forget the soup. They're Mary and Martha. If you have your choice, but it is not a point of having the choice between them. You're supposed to have the soup and the Shakespeare. And they can both be poems, as you know. You know how to make them. It's the business of the elders of this church, Jesus, their elder brother, being at the head, to gather up all the truths in the world pertaining to life and salvation, to the gospel we preach, to the mechanisms of every kind, to the sciences, to philosophy, wherever it may be found in every nation, kindred, tongue, and people, and bring it to Zion, bring it over to our ladder. In other words, practical knowledge is any knowledge that's put to use, as all knowledge should be. A favorite teaching of Brigham Young was that we should use everything we have. Money's meant to be spent, not stored in a vault. Food is meant to be distributed and eaten, not hoarded for speculation. Remember what happened to the manna, that some far-seeing Israelite stored up as a business investment. It promptly became foul and stinking. That was the lesson. Mere accumulation of anything is the act of a miser, the most miserable, the most miserable of men, who has so little faith in God that he must ever build up walls of security around himself. Keep your riches, cries Brother Brigham, and with them I promise you leanness of soul, darkness of mind, narrow and contracted heart. All knowledge must be put to use, if only to beget more knowledge. Well, why? To fill a need, a constant, urgent, vital need. Remember, the mind craves body as the knowledge as the body craves food. And if true knowledge is withheld from it, it will manufacture all manner of false doctrines. Without a steady diet of learning, a person sickens and withers, being false to his own nature. But we treat knowledge today exactly as we treat precious metals and negotiable papers, which, as Brigham Young often reminds us, are in themselves not only worthless, but most pernicious in their effect. We exchange knowledge for tokens, marks on paper, punched holes in cards, impressions on tapes. Then we lock them up in a safe like a Swiss bank. And we make a law that no one may even see our transcript without special permission. The bank gives us a token, a doctor's degree, which we publicly wear at all times. We never let our fellow men forget for a moment that we are sitting on all that knowledge, but make careful provision that he shall never take too close a look at it or ask us to draw upon it in short notice. That simply is not done. This sort of thing, of course, is death to knowledge. For intelligence, the glory of God, is a moral quality. It's defined by the psychologist as problem-solving ability. And how do you solve any problem? The first step, for me or you, is to discover that I do not know about it. I must search out the weak and defective spots in my knowledge, for that ignorance is what makes the problem, of course. The next step is to find out the next thing in order that I must know, which I don't know. And thus I move forward in my quest, progressively laying bare dark new areas of ignorance, looking for the blank spaces on the map, areas of which I knew nothing, or where I've been deceived, where my vanity or enthusiasm have led me astray. It's a humiliating experience. The checks, corrections, revisions, deletions, weary retracings, new beginnings never end. There is no terminal degree. Only the truly humble can take it. I'm not one of them. In fact, it's a very sort of... I would have been far ahead where I am now. I wouldn't be here if I were. Only the truly humble can take it. In fact, it's the very sort of thing that our institutional bookkeeping, poker chip credits, and computed degrees are designed to avoid. The first words I ever heard spoken in a class at the BYU, the only class they ever took here, was the opening statement of a professor at the old Aspen Grove Summer School way back in 1927. He'd just come from the coast with a brand new doctor's degree, and he introduced himself to the class by reporting how the chairman of his committee a few days before had shaken his hand at the conclusion of his final oral exams with the ringing congratulation, "Now you will never have to take another examination as long as you live." And he firmly believed it. It's as if Reed, when he got his degree in music, say, "Well, now you'll never have to play another concert as long as you live. You'll never have to face another audience as long as you live. Great. Never be tested." Some years ago, there was a national scandal when it was discovered that one of the most able and learned professors at the U of U didn't have a degree. That made him a fraud. The immortal Heifetz was not allowed to teach music at UCLA because he didn't have a degree. In all this, it's the wrong ladder, what Brigham Young calls attention to, and he calls it the groveling things of earth. And he says, they are these ladders, you can't climb them both, there are at least two, and you cannot climb them both. That spirit, quoting Brigham here, with the gospel of Christ, interrupts the whole world in their common career, in their every capacity of life. That spirit does not chime in with and harmonize with any earthly kingdom or government, either in their political or religious institutions, but it seems to put a check on everything, to throw into disorder the best-laid plans of the wise and far-seeing among men. In short, it turns the whole current of earthly calculations back upon the world and deluges it in the dark waters of confusion. We expect to be a stumbling block to the whole world and a rock of offense to them. And to the natural man, we are taking an unwise and unnatural course, wherein our religion is obnoxious to the Christian world. They can see nothing more than the natural things. They do not understand the ways of God. They are unacquainted with his doings, with his kingdom, with the principles of eternity. But to see a people who say, "We are the teachers of life and salvation," and yet are anxious to follow the nasty, pernicious fashions of the day, I say it's too insipid to talk about or think about. It is beneath the character of Latter-day Saints that they should have no more independence of mind or feeling than to follow after the groveling customs and fashions of a poor, miserable, wicked world. So at least there are two ladders, and you can't climb them both, as I say. No one supposes. Now, here Brigham Young renounces the conventional ladder of education, success, education for success. No one supposes for a moment that in heaven the angels are speculating, that they're building railroads and factories, taking advantage of one another, gathering up substance there is in heaven to aggrandize themselves, that they live on the same principles we are in the habit of doing. No Christian, no sectarian Christian in the world believes this. They believe that the inhabitants of the earth live as a family, that their faith, interest, and... live as a family. What a mistake. That their faith, interests, and pursuits have one end in view, the glory of God and their own salvation. And they receive more and more. We all believe this, and suppose we go to work and imitate them as far as we can. We should not suffer a covetous and grasping spirit to take possession of us, for the man who possesses the wealth of wisdom would worship no man, would worship the wealth of mammon. We are engaged in a higher tone branch of business than any merchants or railroad men or any institution of an earthly nature. Abraham obtained the promise that he should be the father of lives. In comparison with this, what did Abraham care about machinery, railroads, and other great mechanical productions? The more than anything else, this set the saints off from the rest of the nation during the Gilded Age. In 1870, he wrote a letter to his son who was in Switzerland, and he describes conditions in this country then. It's very interesting. It's so much like our own time. This was the post-war boom, what Mark Twain calls the Gilded Age. We are constantly receiving communications from the elders. It is their testimony with regard to the work of God there, from in Switzerland. There is a coldness in the minds of the people, a total indifference to the gospel and its glorious truths. The whole sum of inquiries is how and where we can make the most money. Of course, there are a few exceptions, but what a condition does this thing indicate? Every species of wickedness is on the increase. The people are fast ripening for destruction. Why is this? The gospel door was open on this land, but these ordinances have been held in derision. The truth has been rejected. Prophets and apostles have been slain for the testimony of Jesus. And now the people have become hardened in iniquity and are led captive to the will of that evil power they prefer to serve, and who promises them that they can have anything in this world for money. From all this, it should be clear that Brigham Young's attitude toward what we would call education for success. A good summary is to be found in one of his many statements on the study of the law. We have to get along here. It's hard for a man to study law without forsaking the spirit of the gospel. This proves there is a lack of sound knowledge in the individual who permits himself to be thus led away. There are many of the inhabitants of the earth who can only look upon one thing. Now, he's talking about specialization for success. Many of these success books will tell you that. You have to concentrate on the one idea. All these get-rich-quick books will tell you that is the big secret, and he's talking about that here. They can look upon only one thing at a time. They forsake the contemplation of everything else for the one idea which occupies the mind. In this they will succeed. There are some of our elders who will argue themselves into a false doctrine by giving undue preference to one scripture, passing over others of equal importance. What President Joseph F. Smith called religious hobbyism. This same lack of comprehensiveness, they're specialized, they're not comprehensive. This same lack of comprehensiveness is also very noticeable at times with some men who happen to accumulate property. And it leads them to forsake the spirit of the gospel. Does it not prove that there is a contractedness of mind in those who do so, which should not be? How contracted, he keeps using that word contracted, you see, how contracted in mind and short-sighted we must be to permit the perishable things of this world to swerve us in the least from our fidelity to the truth. It shows that we lack knowledge which we should possess. I'll skip along here. Brigham Young here puts his finger on the spot as he comments on the unbridgeable gulf that lies between the search for knowledge and the search for success. How difficult it is for our elders to go forth and contend with the learning of the age. When a false theory has to be maintained, it requires study and learning, cunning and sophistry to give it semblance of truth and make it plausible and congenial to the feelings of the people, to sell it, in other words. A child can tell you the truth in childlike language, while falsehood requires a lawyer and a priest to tell it to make it all plausible. It requires a scholastic education to make falsehood pass for truth, and men are educated to promulgate and sustain false theories to make money. That's where the big money lies. But if the profession of a lawyer is chosen, he needs to be educated in all the learning of the age to be successful, to make things appear what they really are not, and that's Plato's definition of rhetoric. Making false things appear as true and true things as false by the manipulation of words. That's the business of public relations, too. And it was natural for the Latter-day Saints to gravitate toward this education for success. Brother Brigham knew his people well. For him, the purpose of education was to take the measure of the world. But for the poor saints who had lived their lives among the ignorant and oppressed, it was its great promise to find a place in the world. He knew how ignorant they were. More, he knew in the light of the great knowledge given them, they easily underestimated their own ignorance. They had barely had a first glimpse of the light when the common enemy flattered them into complacency. Almost instantly shut the door to more light while they busily went about their old activities with renewed assurance. There are a lot of fascinating quotations of them. I'll give you just one on Joseph Smith. But this was so with Latter-day Saints. They weren't up to it at all, he says. I could explain this to Joseph talking in 1843, just before, not a year before he died. I would explain 100-fold more than I ever have, I could, of the glories of the kingdom manifest to me in vision, were I permitted and were the people prepared to receive them. But they couldn't. Wilford Woodruff says here, his mind was opened by the visions of the Almighty, and the Lord taught him many things by vision and revelation that were never taught publicly in his days, for the people could not bear the flood of intelligence which God poured into his mind. Moreover, in view of the great light given them, they've fallen far short of what might fairly be expected of them, and Brother Packard commented on this shortly. Back. This people have not received, says Brigham, improved, grown, and enlarged in their capacities as fast as they should have done. We may look upon ourselves with shamefacedness because of the smallness of our attainments in the midst of so many great advantages. It is mortifying that the children of the world should know more about these things than the children of light. The lack of knowledge manifested by us as a people is disgraceful. The trouble was that the saints were insisted on combining, of course, Zion and Babylon in a new concept of success. The combination was utterly impossible. If you love the one, as the Lord says, you must hate the other. The man or woman who enjoys the spirit of our religion has no trials, but the man or woman who tries to live according to the gospel of the Son of God and at the same time clings to the spirit of the world has trials and sorrows acute and keen, and that too continually. This is the deciding point. He says you must make a decision. It's the watershed. You must move on the one side or the other. You cannot compromise. This is the deciding point. This is the dividing line, one side or the other. They who love and serve God with all their hearts and rejoice evermore, pray without ceasing, and in everything give thanks. But they who try to serve God and still cling to the spirit of the world have got on two yokes, the yoke of Jesus and the yoke of the devil. They will have plenty to do. They will have a warfare inside and outside, and labor will be very galling, for they are directly in opposition to each other. Can't have them both. Conflict between the two projects is summed up in a powerful passage here. Truth, wisdom, power, glory, light, and intelligence exist upon their own qualities. They do not, neither can they exist upon any other principle. Truth is congenial with itself. Light cleaveth unto light. The same with knowledge and virtue and all the eternal attributes. They follow after each other. Truth clings to truth because it is truth. And he goes on and says, if you think that you'll attain to power, you are much mistaken. It's a trick of the unseen power that is abroad among the inhabitants of the earth that leads men astray and binds their mind and subverts them. It is true. Knowledge does give power, but use it for what? If, supposing, says Brigham, that our Father in heaven, our elder brother, the risen Redeemer, the Savior of the world, or any of the gods of eternity should act upon this principle to love truth, knowledge, and wisdom because they are all-powerful, as they are. But if they loved them for that reason, they would cease to be gods, their extension of their kingdom would cease, and their godhead would come to an end. Why should concern for the economy be especially pernicious to the cause of education? Aristotle's famous formula gives us the answer. Uto zein alata eusein. Our project is not to stay alive, but to live as we should. Our real interests and concerns begin where the economy leaves off. Dogs, mice, cockroaches, Aristotle. Elephants and oysters have through the long ages managed to solve the problem of staying alive and reproducing, the problem of survival. So far, God has always provided. He has also promised to provide for us, that's for the sparrows. The question of how much will I get paid is the last question any student should ask, though with us at the BYU, it's invariably the first. In the words of Samuel the Lamanite, you do always think of your riches, always the economy, all the day long. Young Brigham, with his Puritan upbringing, knew as much about the work ethic as anybody, and he despised it. Again, he insists it's the objective that's contemptible. Commendable zeal should not be wasted on the wrong ladder. We admire the billionaire who takes his lunch to work in a paper bag. He is seeking to project the image of the true work ethic while all his life's goal belies it. The real work ethic is dedicated to a life of austerity and plain living and high thinking precisely because its goal is not to accumulate substance. Work less, wear less, eat less, quotation from Brigham, and we shall be a great deal wiser, healthier, and wealthier people than by taking the course we do. You find a mechanic that can go with an old three-cornered file, a jackknife and a spike gimlet, an inch auger, and build a wagon in a workmanlike manner, and you would say he is the superior workman. This is the type of economy and resourcefulness that Brigham admires, not that aimed at the accumulation of a lot of stuff to have power over others. The work ethic is only a method. The objective is the important thing. Which ladder are you climbing? After suitable rest and relaxation, there is not a day, an hour, or a minute that we should spend in idleness. But every minute of every day we should strive to... this sounds like the old work ethic. To improve our minds and increase in the faith of the Holy Gospel. Note which ladder he's climbing. Not the profit motive. We should strive to improve our minds every moment. Cease to send your children out to herd sheep. This is another thing I've heard since I was a child. Involving children in the work of the world sort of develops their characters. Brigham says, on the contrary, it leads them to juvenile delinquency and adult delinquency. We can't go into that. There's interesting stuff there. But the measure of avoidance of real work in our day, I want to talk about this matter, is the growing intrusion of kitsch on the scene. Kitsch, that's what we call camp or corn or something like that. But a more respectable and more established word is the German word kitsch. We're about to tell you what it means. Kitsch is the easy and popular idiom, the lame in art or anything else. The lame surrender to whatever will sell, the bottom line economy. Last Sunday, I heard over KBYU an announcer telling the world they had just listened to the inspired words of Irving Berlin's moving song, God Bless America. Inspired words? Every single line of that song, from God Bless America to My Home Sweet Home, is a cliché, a tried and proven moneymaker. The song in Berlin style is nothing but a pastiche of such catch lines thrown together with clumsy contrivance, none of them invented by the composer themselves, each highly marketable. Kitsch puts the gospel on the celestial level, easy of access to all. No effort is required. The ultimate in kitsch is the commercial. Now, Joseph Smith has said what it is very clearly when he says in this passage about our spirits, our conferences, our councils, our meetings, writing from Liberty Jail, our private as well as public conversations, all too low, too mean, too vulgar, too condescending for the divine dignified characters of called and chosen of God. Now, the word condescending, that's what kitsch is. I just looked it up in Webster. It says condescending, to come down, to descend to another person's level, to accommodate to an inferior, as Dale Carnegie says, if the customer says ain't, you say ain't. That's condescending. And you'll make a sale. You see, it's not being humble at all. It's a trap for the guy to get his money away from him. That's all it is. The customer says ain't, you say ain't. Well, that's what kitsch is. Kitsch tries to escape the impact of reality by limiting our vision to safe and familiar objects. Great music and art, on the other hand, will move you, even disturb and frighten you. Vouchsafe to... What is the normal reaction to those views of celestial things which the gospel has vouchsafed chosen spirits in various dispensations? Always the same. The first reaction is of terror and alarm, of almost intolerable cultural shock. Every interview with an angel must begin, "Don't be afraid, for they were sore afraid." The angel has to say, "Don't be afraid, it's all right." to the extent to which the gospel really influences a creative artist as something of this cultural shock carries over. But surprisingly enough, here's a paradox. This means that there's something to be said for kitsch where the gospel is concerned. In the study of early Christian and Jewish art, it's notable that the nearer we get to the pure, primitive community of saints, the clumsier and less beguiling their art becomes. At the same time, however, it becomes ever more symbolic. It's as if they knew perfectly well that the fourth dimension that gives the gospel its power and its glory simply cannot be captured in any two- or three-dimensional medium. John Chrysostom wrote about that. After all, any attempt to depict celestial glory in any of the limited media of our earthly experience is doomed to be a dismal failure. You just can't do it. The contrast would simply be ridiculous. Religious art and music reach their height in the Baroque. Even then, all is painfully artificial, contrived, forced, theatrical. It's operatic. As Bernini calls his great masterpiece, St. Peter's, it is the Theatrum Dei. It's God's theater. For the real gospel, that will never do. It's better not to try to depict the glories of the eternities than to fall flat on your face. The Egyptians perhaps had the answer. They made no attempt at realism or impressionism, but presented a carefully thought-out arrangement of symbols, mere abstractions. But symbols so intimate and familiar to the beholder that the sight of them had direct impact on his mind and emotions. The greatness of the presentation was all in the beholder's mind. Brigham Young insists that the saints, should stretch their minds and work hard at cultivating taste and not settle for kitsch. Let us, he says, show the world that we have talent and taste, and prove to the heavens that our minds are set on beauty and true excellence, so that we can become worthy to enjoy the society of angels. We enjoy because angels, not just the general public. We enjoy because we have sensibility. Promote this sensibility. Seek to get more and more knowledge, more wisdom, more understanding. This will give us greater sensibility, and we shall know how to enjoy, how to endure. I say, if you want to enjoy, exquisitely become a Latter-day Saint and live the doctrine of Jesus Christ. It's important for Brigham, in all matters of taste and learning, the Latter-day Saints recognize they do not possess a monopoly of taste. It's a basic teaching of Mormonism that the world has good things to offer. Needless to say, many of these things are far advanced of what the underprivileged saints possess. One quotation due here: if there's anything that's great and good and wise among men, it cometh from God. If there are men who possess great ability as statesmen or as philosophers, who possess remarkable scientific knowledge and skill, the credit thereof belongs to God, for he dispenses it to the children of men. Whether they believe him or not, or whether they sin against him or not, it makes no difference. The man can have it. This is the belief and doctrine of the Latter-day Saints. Learn everything the children of men know, and then be prepared for the most refined society on the face of the earth. And accordingly, no Latter-day Saint can be justified in setting up standards of taste until he has the widest possible experience. Brigham comments on the well-known phenomenon that young Latter-day Saints, who had no inkling of how great the gospel is and how much it offers until they go out and see all the other stuff, go out in the world. This is a quotation from him. Our children do not know the greatness of their blessings and privileges. They do not know that they possess the light of the Holy Spirit until they go out into the world and learn the great contrast. True, they hear their fathers pray, and they hear the apostles and the prophets preach, but they cannot know that Mormonism is true for themselves until they have the privilege of being themselves placed in circumstances to exercise faith for themselves and pray to God for themselves for a testimony and knowledge. They must be out there. They can't know on the testimony of somebody else. It won't do. It was this absorption in the larger scene that drew Brigham toward the stage as a powerful vehicle of culture, though his Puritan ancestors are horrified by that. Quite a number of interesting quotes on the stage here. The Lord knoweth all things. A man should know all things pertaining to this life. To obtain this knowledge is right that he should use every feasible means. I do not hesitate to say that the stage can, in a great degree, be made to subserve this end. But this is no mere holding of the mirror up to society as the stage depicts it. For Brigham, we have to have a style of our own. To me, desire to follow the ever-varying fashions of the world manifests a great weakness of mind in either gentleman or lady. We are too apt to follow the foolish fashions of the world. And if the means were plentiful, I do not think there are many families among the Latter-day Saints, but what would be up to the highest and latest fashions of the day. If I do not say too much about the customs and fashions, if I do not say much, I shall probably skip over some very naughty words he's attempting to use. I take the liberty of saying that these fashions are displeasing in the sight of truth, mercy, and justice. Truth, they are not honest. They are kitsch, is what fashion is. Nothing could be more abhorrent to this philosophy, than the practice of using the gospel as an imperative, as a means of selling kitsch, a sales gimmick. The facile, vulgar, sentimental Broadway melody set to equally mawkish words is exalted to the realm of high art if the subject is only the first vision or the temple by the river. This is hitting below the belt. It's like trying to raise the standards and status of a school by giving it the cheap and easy title of the Lord's University. Indeed, when that expression was first used about 1950, some of the general authorities were upset. They found it was both foolish and offensive. When Lehman and Lemuel would claim superior virtue purely by giving themselves and their families the title of the chosen people. Their father rebuked them sharply. He says, "Behold, the Lord esteemeth all flesh in one. He that is righteous is favored as God." Everywhere honest in heart are seeking knowledge, that is the Lord's university. And if they don't hear, it isn't, of course. The Latter-day Saints are often reminded, well, I'm going to skip that one. The things, get pretty strong there, the things of the mind call for the highest order of discipline. Everyone wants to lay down the rules of taste. And this thing, Brigham says, this we must not do. He recognizes that, though it's no more natural for your lungs to expand and contract in breathing than it is for you to wish to be others to be like yourselves. All of these classes act according to their faith and traditions. Each one of them says, if you are not as I am, you are not right. And this is just as natural as it is to breathe vital air. I wish this trait in the saints to be done away. I want the elders of Israel to learn to take people as they are. And also, according to Brigham, each one of us not only has the right to taste and opinions of his own, but has the obligation to advocate them. That diffidence or timidity we must dispense with. When it becomes our duty to talk, we ought to be willing to talk. If we never exhibit the knowledge within us, the people wouldn't know really whether we have any. Interchange our ideas. Exhibit that which we believe and understand. That will afford an opportunity for detecting and correcting errors, increasing our stock of valuable information. I've frequently thought that I should be very happy if I could hear the elders speak their feelings. What about your taste in this matter? And impart their knowledge pertaining to their fellow beings, earthly things, heavenly things, to godliness and God. Thus we can advocate our ideas, but never force them on another. Brigham has a nice passage here. He says, no person, no matter what his office is, has the right to say to another, why do you eat wheat bread, corn bread, or no bread at all? Why do you eat potatoes, or why don't you eat them? Why do you walk, or why do you sit down? Why do you read this book, or why do you read that book? Or why do you go to the right or to the left? If the elders of Israel could understand this a little better, we would like it, for the simple reason that if they had the power given them now, they manifest the same weakness in the exercise thereof as any other people. Brigham Young had no use for those who waited on the judgment of others. One place he says, there are people in the church who say, if it's all right with the brethren, it's all right with me. Then he says, this is not pleasing in the sight of the Lord. Those men and women who know no more about the power of God and the influence of the Holy Spirit than to be led by another person, suspend their own understanding and pin their faith upon another's sleeve, will never be capable of entering to the celestial glory. He has a good deal on that particular thing of depending on others, which you shouldn't do. You cannot delegate your free agency to anyone. Granted, there never was, he says, there never was and never will be a people on heaven or in earth, in time or in eternity, that can be considered truly and entirely independent of counsel and direction. They have to get it, but they have to ask for it. He says, if they don't believe in my advice, teachings, and counsels, they are at perfect liberty to disbelieve them, and I will not find one word of fault with them for so doing. We have history enough to prove that when men have the power, their motto is, you shall. Here's the tendency. But there is no such thing in the economy of heaven. 121st section. Of course, we run the risk of being confronted by all manner of false doctrines this way and so forth. That's part of the game. Brigham Young's son Willard very shrewdly observed in a letter to his father in 1876 that his friends who had left the church did so, I'm quoting, not because of instructions they got that misled them so much as the want of proper instructions. The trouble was that they heard too much. It was not that they heard too much, but they didn't hear enough. It was no teachings they got that drove them out of the church, from outside or anywhere else. It's what they hadn't got yet. They hadn't looked far enough. Well, in short, Brigham's teaching, quote, breathes that spirit of liberty and the pursuit of knowledge characteristic of the work of God in these latter days. Well, I conclude then with a, because we've got to wait to hear Brother Madsen to make it worthwhile to come to this meeting. I conclude with a sentimental journey I took the other night within the last weekend. It began when I found my overstuffed mailbox, alas for the forests of America, an impressive flyer from the BYU Travel Study, an elegantly inscribed Hebrew version of Orson Hyde's prayer dedicating the Holy Land in 1841, along with an invitation, quote, to be instructed more perfectly of the things both in heaven and in earth. What better way to be instructed, said the blurb, than by scholars from the church education system while standing on the Mount of Olives where Orson Hyde's dedicatory prayer was offered. With this, the customer was provided with a list of almost 20 to choose from. The question arises, which of these professional scriptorians can read the Hebrew prayer, or for that matter, make heads or tails of any ancient manuscript? Can all of them? Can any of them? I leave it to you to discover. I wouldn't say that. Intrigued by this, I went to the Travel Study office for more information, and as I left was attracted by an impressively drawn placard announcing a series of courses, an official announcement, in a certain department in which I could choose to take primitive pottery, spelt with an A, primitive, or NRA Hunter Safty, S-A-F-T-Y, or at interim classes, INT, E-R-U-M fashion. Well, having long been at the BYU, I was neither shocked nor surprised by this sort of thing, which I've seen a thousand times. The impressive facade with nothing behind it is the rule, not the exception with us. I'm reminded of the announcers over KBYU with their oh-so-cultured accents as they elaborately mispronounce all the proper names. As I left the place, I picked up another brochure inviting the public to enter into the great adventure into learning. This surely is the real thing. I open the brochure and am challenged to extend my questing mind through courses in slimnastics, cake decorating, auto maintenance, and a more feminine you. From there, I passed to the bookstore and was reminded both of what Brother King has recently said about it, a vulgar place and a monopoly, and of the fact that for the upwards of 100 years, Provo has been a university town without a single bookstore. What on earth could the students have been doing all that time? To find out, I listened to their conversations among themselves that I have for 30 years now. The one thing you would never guess from such conversations is that you're at an institution of learning. The subjects are, and this is where they come out, you'll find every time, their first, jobs and money, second, cars, third, social activity, religious and romantic. Quite recently, Brother Thomas Rogers, speaking from higher and more official level of observation, has announced the same verdict. BYU students simply are not interested in things of the mind. From the bookstore, by a natural transition, I pass to the library. This is a sore point with me. Without the new edition, we already have shelf space for over 1 million volumes, but where any thought of serious research, but here, any thought of serious research is out of the question, because the officials, to save time and trouble and make room for new acquisitions, simply took all the bound periodicals earlier than 1970 and locked them up in a warehouse. Now, the heart and program of serious study in any field is the periodical literature of the past century. But can you make a librarian see that? Well, never mind, the books will not be missed. That became apparent to me as I left the library late at night and walked home through an empty and deserted campus. As I have done thousands of times in the past when I was young and more vigorous, I used to stay up here all hours, morning, night, working off on things. But going home, the lights do not burn late on Temple Hill. They never have. Descending the steps to take me home down the south side, I remember President Harris and his interest in making a lovely natural preserve on the south side of the campus. Now what we have is the carefully manicured, groomed, trimmed, regimented landscape where nothing is allowed to grow in its wild or natural state. Nature must observe our dress standards. The look comes first. Nothing else really matters. I noticed, as I always do, the smoke pouring from the power plant and asked myself again, what is it we produce that is worth the price of all that pollution? Certainly not knowledge. I was reminded that most of our smartest students are now working with computers. They're not discovering or absorbing knowledge, but simply processing it. Neither producers nor consumers of the precious stuff, but middlemen, dutiful attendants on the machines. And if not knowledge, not character either. Woodrow Wilson says, character is a byproduct, a byproduct of hard work well done. You don't give courses in character. So I've come full circle. My first day in Provo, the first day I was in Provo, I was at Reed and Roy Robertson. And he told us, he just had a conversation with Joseph F. Smith. He said, and President Smith had said a thing that I have never forgotten. This is President Joseph Fielding. He said, we are rapidly coming to be known as a mediocre people. Why must this be? In a letter written just 100 years ago, Brigham Young clearly states his purpose in founding the BYU at Provo. He says, we have enough and to spare at present in these mountains of schools where the young infidels are made, because the teachers are so tender-footed that they dare not mention the principles of the gospel to their pupils, but have no hesitancy in introducing into the classroom the theories of Huxley, Darwin, or of Mial, and the false political economy which contends against cooperation and the united order. This course I am resolutely and uncompromisingly opposed to, and hope to see the day when the doctrines of the gospel will be taught in all our schools, when the revelation of the Lord will be our text, and our books will be written and manufactured by ourselves and in our own midst. As a beginning in this direction, I have endowed the Brigham Young Academy at Provo. I'm now seeking to do the same in this city. Now, there is the centennial announcement of the founding of the Brigham Young University, and that its purpose. The avowed purpose of the founder, then, was to resist the tendency of the Latter-day Saints to make timid concessions to the opinions of the world in scientific, artistic, social, and economic matters. As long as we continue to lean over backwards to accept without question anything bearing the stamp of scientific authority from beyond the mountains, or to limit our artistic productions to whatever sells best to the general public, or to avoid at any price offending what has come to be known as the establishment, we shall remain as Brigham Young described to the saints, last quote, fixed with a very limited amount of knowledge, and like a door upon its hinges, move to and fro from one year to another without any visible advancement or improvement. Man is made in the image of God, but what do we know of him or of ourselves when we suffer ourselves to love and worship the God of this world, riches? that the Lord may enlighten all our minds with a fuller understanding of his purposes, I pray in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.